Everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of public interest. On your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Genesis Flood when we return. Now, let me ask you this. What do you think is wrong with the Ten Commandments? Well, it's pretty obvious that something is terribly wrong with the Ten Commandments because they have been banned from our public schools, public institutions, and our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they teach the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our schools, public institutions, and we've made them a part of our national psyche. You know, this is a radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion? An abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent. That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the benefits for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what that penalty is to suffer its effect. So whether you call the Mosaic Law the law of God, the common law, natural law, or karma, or something else, it's automatic, and it acts just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about the Genesis Flood, a book written by Whitcomb and Morris back in the 1960s. It's just as scientific and just as up to date today as it was back in the 60s when I first read it. I use it as a textbook here in the law school, especially in our Mosaic Law School. You know, law, by definition, is immutable. The law of gravity never changes. These natural laws that we observe around us, such as the law of gravity, or the laws of thermodynamics, or the laws of physics, these we call natural laws. Well, the Ten Commandments are natural laws. It doesn't require a policeman standing outside of Mustang Ranch to give you a ticket when you come out of Flo's whorehouse. AIDS, herpes, and VD, venereal warts, and a whole host and plethora of other diseases and maladies come from sexual abuse, whether it's adultery, fornication, or some other malignant use of a good thing called sex. And you can go through the Ten Commandments one by one, just like I did here with the example of adultery, and there's a natural penalty. You see, when God set this thing up, he put natural penalties. And you say to yourself, well, what in the hell is the natural penalty for, let's say, theft? You know, I steal a car, I part it out, and I sell it, and that's the way I make my living. The natural penalty is 5 times the amount of the theft. Well, nobody knows about it. Oh, yeah. See, it doesn't require that anybody knows about it. The natural penalty is you're going to lose 5 times the amount that you stole. We Americans have been stealing through the use of stocks and bonds and interest and usury and mortgages and commercial paper, and got real serious about it about 1933 when Franklin Roosevelt came into office. At that time, we had a debt of a few billion dollars. Today, it's $8 trillion. We have a total of $149 trillion of debts. Our economy is on eggshells, and it's about ready to collapse. That's the penalty for theft. And it's automatic. You didn't require anybody to come around, give you a ticket, haul you into court, and give you a fine or lock you up in jail. We're all paying the penalty. We've lost 96.5% of the purchasing power of our money since 1930. You're in debt up to your eyeballs, and you and your wife together can't pay all the bills. And most Americans are in debt up to their eyebrows. Now, there's a basis for this. It's called evolution in education. We jumped the tracks of sanity back in 1933. And we haven't gotten back onto the tracks of sanity from that day to this. And Whitcomb and Morris point out many of these scientific errors that came from evolutionary philosophy that replaced in our science the law of God and the Ten Commandments. Now, that's nothing to do with religion. I'm not here to get you to give your heart to Jesus or to repent or to do something that's real embarrassing. I'm just a reporter, and I'm here to tell you that if you break a law, there's a penalty. It's just that simple. You got a mortgage on your house, the interest is the penalty. And that interest works compounding. It grows geometric. And if you bought a house, at the end of 5 years, you hit the break-even point, and from that point on, every payment you make is a loss. I know you're living in the house. I know nobody explained it to you. I know you didn't know that, but it doesn't change anything. It's like jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. Well, I didn't know you were supposed to put a parachute on. You're going to fall down at the rate of 32 feet a second. When you get to the bottom, everything's going to be fine until the sudden stop. And that's the way life is. Life is filled with laws. And in the Genesis flood, written by Whitcomb and Morris, are the parameters of natural law. You've maybe never seen it before on a college textbook level, but this is the book that explains it. I'm sorry that the book is a little dry, dull, and boring, and I'm sorry that it's not, you know, written from the point of view of, real excitement, a Mickey Spillane thriller, but, that's the way life is. Sometimes knowledge just comes in dribs and drabs, and sometimes wisdom comes the same way, and it's kind of dull, dry, and uninteresting, but that's the story. Now, let me finish up in the series of programs on the Genesis flood with evolution and education, and then we'll take a look at about 10 of these stories that I told you about, like the magnetic field, the sun, Niagara Falls, erosion, topsoil, meteorology, the light, parted sedimentation, atmospheric helium, and the Mississippi Delta, just to name a few of the various sciences where the mathematics do not add up for evolution. Now, the theory of evolution with its mechanistic philosophy and humanistic ethics has actually permeated not only the biological sciences, but also the physical sciences and social sciences, even in this country. The social sciences especially have become almost completely dominated by the evolutionary perspective. And these disciplines, with their more immediate impact on actual human relationships and conduct through modern sociology, psychology, economics, psychiatry, criminology, all of which are almost completely organized now in terms of evolutionary philosophy and evolutionary concepts. They have had a far greater influence on modern society than most people realize. Especially important is the influence that the evolutionary philosophy and ethics have had on our educational system. And I'll pause here and underline this word ethics. I know they say, well, it isn't ethical. Well, let me tell you, the word ethics is simply political jargon, politically correct jargon for law. And so we come along and we don't want to say, well, what we're doing is replacing the law of God. What we're doing is we are practicing ethics. Now, what you're doing is you're practicing your own law. You have decided that the law of God is bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil. We're not doing it, and we're going to practice something that's ethical, whatever this thing ethical is. So ethics to a Baptist is something different than ethics to a Catholic. And ethics to a criminologist or a sociologist or a teacher is something different than thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt have no other gods before me, and so on down the line. We have replaced law with what we call ethics. The truth of the matter is they're both the same. It's just that you're not practicing the law of God, you're practicing the law of ethics, whatever your ethics are. Now, not only is organic evolution either assumed or openly taught throughout the curriculum of the public schools of our country, it is the very foundation of this entire educational philosophy upon which our modern system of progressive education is built. The major architect of the system is everywhere acknowledged to be John Dewey, whose great schools of education at the University of Chicago and Columbia University have had unparalleled influence in molding the entire educational system and philosophy of our nation's schools. His biographer says of him that the starting point of his system of thought is biological. He sees man as an organism in an environment, remaking as well as being made. Things are to be understood through the origins and their functions without the intrusion of supernatural considerations. So John Dewey rejected God, rejected the law of God, and replaced it with ethics. He came up with his own system of ethics. This is evolutionary philosophy. Okay. Well, now that we have accepted evolutionary philosophy, we put it in our schools, we put it in our criminal justice system, we put it in our politics and so on, there's a result that comes from it. And the year 2005 in America, the way you see it, is the results of the evolutionary philosophy in every discipline, in every profession in our nation today. All right? If that's what you wanted, you should be in hog heaven. We have arrived. The millennium is here. John Dewey and progressive education and the New Age society has arrived. Now, if on the other hand, you look at the world today and you say, my God, what a mess this is. Well, then there's an obvious solution. You go back to doing whatever it was that we were doing when Johnny could read, when America was the world's number one creditor nation instead of the world's number one debtor nation, when our political process was honest, when our military fought wars to protect America, not to protect General Motors or Exxon or Standard Oil. See, things were different 100 years ago than they are today. So the solution would seem to me would be to go back to doing whatever it was that we were doing in 1905 as opposed to what we're doing today. You take a look at our monetary system and you say, my God, we lost 96.5% of the purchasing power of our money. We didn't lose any purchasing power in our money from 1787 to 1905. It still had the same purchasing power, the same amount of gold in the dollars, the same amount of silver in our dollars. We didn't suffer from inflation. Today we suffer from inflation. Today we suffer from the depreciation of our money. Cause and effect. Cause and effect. So it is, boys and girls, cause and effect. Now, the scientific weakness of the evolutionary hypothesis should be apparent to us. It isn't, but it should be. And the remarkable thing is that despite its widespread acceptance as the scientific explanation of origins and processes, there is such a small amount of actual scientific evidence in favor of evolution, and there is certainly no evidence of any genuine evolution occurring in our present experience. It isn't something that we're observing today or that we can test in the laboratory. Organic diversity is an observational fact more or less familiar to everyone. If we assemble as many individuals living at a given time as we can, we notice at once that the observed variation does not form any kind of continuous distribution. Instead, a multitude of separate, discrete distributions are found. In other words, the living world is not a single array of individuals in which any two variants are connected by unbroken series of intergrades, but it's an array of more or less distinctly separate arrays, intermediates, between which are absence or rare. And with respect to present processes of change, especially genetic mutations, we've already seen that these are practically always processes of deterioration and seldom, if ever, produce any real progress in evolution. Every time you see a variant, every time you see a mutant, it is less able to survive than its parent. I saw some mutant fruit flies. They were certainly fruit flies, and they were certainly different than any other fruit flies, and they couldn't fly. How in the hell does that make them more adapted to the environment and better able to survive? Boys and girls, when we look at mutants, we're looking at degeneration. We're not looking at regeneration or generation. It's the exact opposite. Now, all of the real evidence from present species and their variation supports perfectly the biblical revelation that God created all living things after their kinds. There isn't any evidence of present-day biological change except within small limits and certainly within their kinds. Evolutionists may say, and they must say, that even though mutations are always harmful, the very few that may be helpful are acted upon by natural selection and preserved, and that in the course of the great ages of geologic time, these favorable changes gradually accumulate to bring about true progress in evolution. And for their proof that this is so, they point triumphantly to the fossil record of former life on the Earth. The fossils are supposed to show the actual record of evolutionary change over the ages. Thus, the geneticist Goldschmidt says in this vein, quote, fortunately, there is a science which is able to observe the progress of evolution through the history of our Earth. Geology traces the rocky strata of our Earth, deposited one upon another in the past geological epochs through hundreds of millions of years, and finds out their order and timing and reveals organisms which lived in all of these periods. Paleontology, which studies the fossil remains, is thus enabled to present organic evolution as a visible fact, unquote. But when we ask for details, he is told, for example, by the paleontologist Simpson, in spite of these examples, it remains true, as every paleontologist knows, that most new species, genera, and families, and that nearly all categories above the level of families appear in the record suddenly and are not led up to by known, gradual, completely continuous transitional sequences. Put another way, boys and girls, there's no missing links. We've been looking for 200 years, or close to it. How come there are no missing links? There's no missing links because evolution isn't a true science. It is a philosophy. It's a belief. It's a religion. I'm not opposed to religion. Hell, everybody's got a right to his religion. I just don't think that evolutionary religion should be imposed upon us at taxpayer expense, any more than Roman Catholicism should be imposed upon us at taxpayer expense. Dr. Dwight Davis, he's a curator of vertebrate anatomy in the Chicago Museum of Natural History, also recognizes these gaps in the record. Davis said, the sudden emergence of major adaptive types as seen in the abrupt appearance in the fossil record of families and orders continued to give trouble. The phenomenon lay in the genetical no man's land beyond the limits of experimentation. A few paleontologists even today cling to the idea that these gaps will be closed by further collecting. But most regard the observed discontinuities as real and have sought an explanation. These explanations are always highly speculative, involving concepts of explosive evolution, a continental migration, macro mutations and the like. Davis is willing to admit this. He said, but the facts of paleontology conform equally well with other interpretations that have been discredited by neobiological work. For example, divine creation, and paleontology by itself can neither prove nor refute such ideas. Paleontology can't prove divine creation and can't disprove it. We don't know. I'm not here to sell the creation. I mean, choices are up to you to make. I'm just a reporter who reports facts. I'm going to pause right here, and I brought up some facts in the six preceding programs in this series. I brought up, for example, the story of the sun. Do you remember that? Let me just read to you the salient point here on the sun. The sun is shrinking. It's a fact that the sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by 0.1% per century, and scientists have been watching for over 100 years now, and the evidence is conclusive. Every hour the sun is shrinking by 5 feet. If the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. If the sun existed 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. And as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origins of the sun. You hear that last sentence? As far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage. That's called uniformitarianism. If it's shrinking 5 feet a day today, it was shrinking 5 feet a day yesterday, and on back through time for billions and billions of years. And as I pointed out to you here a couple, three programs back, I said, hell, just do the arithmetic on that. For 100 years, scientists have been spending money studying the sun, and they finally figured out, hey, it's getting smaller, it's burning up. It's kind of like a match, you know, you strike a match and it's burning up. And as the match burns up, it consumes itself. It changes itself from a match into a cinder, into an ash. You can observe that. You can repeat that in the laboratory. And that's what science is all about. Science is about absolute facts. Science is about the truth. Science is about we can repeat it and do it over and over and over again. Now, the evolutionists come along here and they tell us, well, you know, 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs died out. Well, now, listen, which one of these scientists are telling us the truth? 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs died out, or 20 million years ago, the diameter of the sun would have been the size of the distance between the Earth and the sun today, which is 93 million miles. Now, which is it? That's why I said all you got to do is do the numbers. Now, I do the numbers on the sun, and here are the, I don't know what you call these sun scientists. I guess they're physicists. And then they're doing their research, and I'm sure they all believe in evolution. And they do their arithmetic, and they make their reports, and some reporter reported that in a newspaper somewhere. It's probably reported in the, you know, some scientific magazine. Doesn't anybody ever correlate these gaffes? Doesn't anybody ever look at these obvious, inconsistent evolutionary ideas and couple those with the scientific facts and then say, geez, this is stupid. There were no dinosaurs on this planet 65 million years ago if the sun is being consumed at the rate of 5 feet an hour and if uniformitarianism is true. So either the sun isn't being consumed at 5 feet an hour, uniformitarianism isn't true because there have been changes. It hasn't been uniform. There may have been times when the sun was only being burned up at 1 foot per hour or 1 foot per day or 300 feet an hour or some other variations in between, or the dinosaurs died out at some time after 65 million years ago. It had to have been within the last million, 2 million, 5 million, or certainly within the last 20 million years, because the sun could not have, the Earth could not have existed 20 million years ago, because the sun itself at 5 feet an hour would have been 93 million miles in diameter and it would have incinerated the Earth. All right, now that's one. That's the sun. Let me put an X by that one. Let's take a look at another one here. Remember the story I told you about Niagara Falls? Niagara Falls is a fact. It's up in New York State. You can walk, you drive up to Buffalo, New York, and you go out here in the boondocks a little ways, and you'll find this big waterfall up there. I went up and looked at it. It was pretty spectacular. Now, here's what we learned about it. The famous waterfall, Niagara Falls, is a magnificent example of a geologic clock. It reveals a very young Earth, because the rim of the falls is wearing back at a known rate every year, and geologists recognize that it has only taken 5,000 years to erode from its original precipice. Do you know that? I don't know what you call these guys. I guess you call them geologists. And they go up there and they watch the rim of Niagara Falls. And it breaks off and it falls down into the chasm below. And they measure that every year, every year, every year. They spend taxpayer dollars measuring the receding lip of the Niagara Falls. And God bless them for doing it. And it's your tax dollars at work. Now, once you've done that, you can say, well, it wears back at the rate of a foot a year. Now, let's go ahead here, a foot a year for 5,000 years. And that takes us over here. Oh, here's where it started. Here's where it began. And the way it's wearing back today, if uniformitarianism is true, and the amount that it's wearing back today is the same as it has always been worn back from time immemorial, and it didn't have a sudden catastrophe and wear back, you know, at 1,000 feet a year. It's always been just a few feet, whatever it is. It didn't say here in the article. Now, can you see that science, that discipline right there tells you that Dinosaurs weren't here 65 million years ago. The Earth is young. It's around 6,000 years old. And from the flood, 5,000 years, that's exactly right. The flood occurred about 4,300 years ago. The flood occurred 1,656 years after Adam was created. So you take 6,000 years and you date that back, you know, 1,656, and they'll tell you just roughly, you know, around 4,300 years ago. Let's try another one. Erosion. Remember the story about erosion? See if I can find erosion here. Here it is. Listen to this. When we talk about erosion, what's even more surprising is the discovery that all of the continents on Earth would be worn down to sea level in 14 million years. But there isn't any evidence for such drastic erosion. The mountains and valleys on Earth appear to have been very recently made. They are sharp and angular in appearance, and it testifies to their youthfulness. All right? I imagine that some scientist wrote that. It's in some science textbook. It's a citation that was taken out of a science textbook. I pulled it out of a book that pulled it out of a science textbook. Which textbooks, I don't know off the top of my head, but I can find it. Now, here's a science textbook that's in your schools. Maybe you read it yourself. Maybe you were trained out of this particular book. And it says, hey, listen, 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs died out. Okay, but scientists measure the amount of dirt that comes down the Mississippi River. Did you know that? I mean, there's guys out there that are taking water samples, and they measure the amount of mud that's in a bucket, and then they calculate how many gallons of water are running out the mouth of the Mississippi and how fast that it's dropping silt out into the Gulf of Mexico, and then they put all that information into a computer. Now, here's the bottom line to this. If uniformitarianism is true, and we go back in time, 14 million years, then the Earth should be as flat and worn down as a billiard ball, because at the rate that we see the dirt coming out the mouth of the rivers, the continents are wearing down at the rate of 14 million years, it would be down to sea level. So you could go back 14, 28, and then 4, 8, 12, 42 million years. And then, you know, hey, listen, 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs died out. And we've had time for the Earth to wear itself down to the level of the oceans four times over. Can you follow that? And these guys, they stay with their story. You got to admit that, but their story doesn't add up. Uniformitarianism doesn't add up. The numbers don't come out. Let's try another one. I'll put a little X here by that one. And now here's one about sedimentation. Listen to this. Consider the present rate of erosion tearing down the world's land masses and then filling into the oceans. The indications of continental geography show that past rates of erosion have been much greater than today's rate. But let's leave that equation out and go just with uniformitarianism. At the present rate of erosion today, there should have accumulated at least 30 times more sediment in the ocean than there actually is today. Of course, this is based on the assumption that the ocean has been there for at least 1 billion years. Okay. So they go out here and they measure how much sediment's coming out the mouth of the Mississippi River. Then they go out here and they measure how much sediment is out there already. And they plug that into the computer profile. And they come back here and they say, well, gosh, there should be more sediment out there if the world is older, if the amount of sediment that's running down the rivers today, if we just extrapolate this back, there should be 30 times more sediment in the world's oceans than there is today. Again, you see the numbers don't add up. Why is that? Well, that's because if there was a flood 4,300 years ago, then the amount of silt that you see out in the oceans today is the right amount. And if you take a look at the rate that the sun is burning itself up, if the sun was created 6,000 years ago, that's fine. No problem with that. Fits right into the program. If you take a look at Niagara Falls, 4,300 years ago, the flood ended. The Niagara Falls started wearing away, and 4,300 years later, it's back to where it is, and it's about 5,000 years. The difference between 4,300 and 5,000, 700 years. That's in the ballpark. But it's not in the ballpark when you say the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago and Niagara Falls was flowing over the falls and everything continues on as it has been in the past. Everything is the same today as it always has been in the past. Well, hang on here, boys and girls. I got to give you a reminder and then we'll continue. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our webpage. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page at the website, georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, history, religion, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, what did I say here? Sedimentation. Let me put an X by sedimentation. Flip the page. Let's talk about the magnetic field. Now, I don't know who studies magnetic fields. Maybe it's physicists again. Maybe it's geologists. But listen to this report on our magnetic field. It seems to be degenerating. They've been measuring it now since about 1835. This is called, listen to this. Physicist Thomas Barnes points out that the Earth's magnetic field has been decaying regularly since it was first measured in 1835. Now, if the half-life of the magnetic field is what Dr. Barnes has shown from careful measurements, the conclusion is that the Earth's magnetic field would have to have been equal to that of a magnetic star as little as 10,000 years ago. Now, that's according to Dr. Barnes, to be consistent with the laws of physics, and assuming that the magnetic field has continually weakened, we can only conclude that life on Earth would not have been possible more than 10,000 years ago. All right, let me tell you a little story. I was reviewing a book not too long ago. I can't remember all the numbers or exactly how it came out, but in dealing with this thing of the magnetic field, it degenerates by half every so many years. So those of you that can count know that this is called geometric progression. You know, it goes 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. Now, the magnetic field is absolutely essential for biologic life to live on planet Earth. When the magnetic field goes down to zero, life will cease to exist here. The magnetic field is on its way down to zero, and it's going to reach zero in a period of time in the not-too-distant future. It's out, you know, I don't know, 500 or 1,000 years from now. It's not a million years. It's just a 500 or 1,000. It's in this millennium. Now, we've only had the technological know-how to measure this thing since 1835, but they can see that it is lowering every, I don't know if it's 5 or 10 years, something like that. They can see that it goes down. So somebody put his pencil to it and said, well, gee, if it's degenerating by this much every decade, then here's how much it must be degenerating. And we know how strong it is today, and it degenerates by this amount. So out here at this time frame, or in this time frame, it's going to degenerate by half. It's going to be half as powerful. Now, the magnetic field today is about half as powerful as it was 1,000 years ago, which was half as powerful as it was 2,000 years ago, which is half as powerful as it was 4,000 years ago, and so on down the line. And it's degenerating. All right, now here's what that tells us. If you go back in time and you keep doubling the magnetic field's power, in 10,000 years you come up to the magnetic star level, which means that a man who now weighs 200 pounds on planet Earth would weigh 200 million tons. Wouldn't be able to lift his right foot. Couldn't walk. That's what that boils down to. So again, the numbers work against evolutionary philosophy, work against uniformitarianism, which may have been a great theory in 1830 when Lyell came up with this idea that, well, everything that we're looking at today is probably the same as it has been for the last 50 million or 50 billion years. The truth of the matter is it isn't. And the magnetic field is one more discipline or one more science that proves that evolution is just a can of worms. It fits perfectly in with creation, fits perfectly in with the Noah's flood. Simply this, the Earth was created 6,000 years ago. The magnetic field 6,000 years ago was so strong. And if you take a look at the way it's degenerated over the past 6,000 years, it fits right in with the numbers. Now, there are books on the magnetic field, and there's lots of studies that are done. I think I saw a synopsis of it at the Creation Science Conference in 1992. I think that's where I read that story. Now, tuck that one away in your heart, boys and girls, and do a little research on this thing called the magnetic field, and I think you'll come to the conclusion that Dr. Barnes did, that, hey, listen, this story doesn't add up. Let's take a look at atmospheric helium. Where's magnetic fields right there? Atmospheric helium. Listen to this story. This light gas, called helium, which you use to fill balloons, is steadily gathering in the outer reaches of our atmosphere. The total amount there can be measured, and one of the sources for this thing called helium is the constant measurable decay of uranium down here on planet Earth. Now, if the Earth is billions of years old, then our atmosphere would be saturated with helium to such a degree that there would be up to a million times more helium up in the atmosphere than we have now. This is what we call the helium clock, and it insists that the Earth cannot be more than 10 to 15,000 years old. So now let's take a helium scientist, whoever these helium scientists are, and they go out here and they measure the amount of helium that's in the atmosphere. They're probably looking for carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide and a bunch of other gases. They call them greenhouse gases. They're probably looking for these greenhouse gases. And they take a look at helium and they say, hey, this helium that we can measure out here, there's so much of it. And here's how much there is. Then they can go back and say, well, here's how much there was in 1900. Here's how much there was in 1920, 30, 40, 50, 60, and so on. And as they measure how much it is gaining every year, they can go back in time and say, well, gosh, if it's gaining this X amount per year, then it must have had X amount in 1899 and 1898 and so on. You extrapolate it back and they come to the conclusion, gosh, there should be many times more helium in the atmosphere if, in fact, it has been accumulating at the rate that we're able to measure it today. Hey, here's another geologic clock, which is exactly like Niagara Falls. You simply measure the amount of helium in the atmosphere, and you say, well, there should be more there. It's just like the sediment in the ocean. Hey, listen, if this is how much is being deposited out there every year, if we go back 30,000 years, here's how much more should have been there, and so on back down the line. I mean, it works both ways. Let's try another one. What do we got here? Meteorology, light-parted, atmospheric helium. Let me put an X right there and turn the page. The Mississippi River Delta. Listen to this. The watershed of the Mississippi River transports a tremendous amount of silt downstream to the Gulf of Mexico. Every year, the delta deposit is enlarging by a known amount. There isn't any indication that any of this silt has ever been carried very far out to sea. At the present rate, the entire Mississippi River Delta would have accumulated in about 5,000 years. And science acknowledges that the river has been even bigger in the past. It's been even bigger in the past. Yeah, take a look at this. When you cross the river out of Tennessee and you cross over, it's 90 miles of river delta. That river at one time was 90 miles wide. When the water was draining off of the piece of real estate that we call the Louisiana Purchase, it was draining off at the rate of whatever it was that filled up 90 miles across there. In any event, when we take a look at the Mississippi Delta, it would have fit exactly into Noah's flood. It's within the last 5,000 years. But if we go back and we take a look at the size of the Mississippi Delta over the past 5,000 years, and we say, well, gee, boys, let's go back 10,000 years. It should be double the size that it is, 20,000 years, four times, and so on. Hey, that delta should be a lot bigger than it is today if we're going to go back a million, a billion, 5 billion years. So we have to come to the conclusion, well, everything wasn't the same as it is today. Things were different at some time in the past. And that's the point of catastrophism. That's the point of the Bible. But there have been some cataclysmic events in the past, and these cataclysmic events of the past have shaped our world that we live in today. That's all. That's where reality's at. Not that it makes a rat's rectum's worth the difference in finding an oil pool. I don't think that special creation is going to help you geologists out there find any more oil or any less oil. But it'll give you a different perspective on reality when you come to the conclusion that, hey, listen, this magnetic field, the sun, Niagara Falls, erosion, sedimentation and atmospheric helium are all evolutionary lies. How many have we got so far? 2, 4, 6. Let's take a look at another one. Topsoil. You know, one writer observed that the soil, which sustains life on planet Earth, is a very thin layer of an average depth of 6 or 7 inches. It's an average depth of about 7 inches over the entire Earth. Now, the Earth underneath is just as dead and sterile as the moon. It is that thin film is all that stands between man and extinction. How long does it take for topsoil to accumulate? Well, scientists estimate that the combination of plant growth, bacterial decay, and erosion produces about 6 inches of topsoil in 5,000 years. That would total 6,500 feet of topsoil in 65 million years. You got that, boys and girls? Now, by observation, of course, this will be a little different from place to place, but when I went to ag school, they told us that topsoil builds up at the rate of approximately 1 inch every 90 years. 1 inch about every 90 years. So in 1,000 years, you ought to come up with about 10 inches of topsoil, round numbers. So in 6,000 years from the creation, go back 4,000 years to the flood, and you're building up topsoil, then go to Iowa or go to some places around the world where there is some actual topsoil, and you'll see that it's about 5 or 6 feet deep. California Central Valley has 5 or 6 feet of topsoil in it. Makes all the sense in the world. That topsoil has developed by the rivers washing the silt down along the riverbank. So from the buffalo eating the grass and pooping on the ground. And by the way, just for your information, a cow or a buffalo produces 35 pounds of soil a day. Isn't that just special? So when God made those cows and buffalo, he was making dirt, making topsoil, the rate of 35 pounds a day. It's about an inch every 90 years. Okay, it's rounded off to an inch every century, about a foot in round numbers every 1,000 years. Go back 4,000 years and you got about 4 feet. Now, right here in the Ozarks, we had 2 feet of topsoil measured in 1880, where I'm standing, right here, where I live, right here, Ozark County, had 2 feet of topsoil. Now, you students listening to me right now that have been here to school, how much topsoil did you observe when you drove in here? I'm telling you, boys and girls, there isn't any topsoil on this ground. If it is, it isn't an inch. We've got clay and rock. Clay and rock. There's no topsoil here. There's a little topsoil down in the bottoms, but not up here on top of the ridges. What happened to all of our topsoil? Well, back in the 1880s, the railroad and logging companies came in here and clear-cut all this forest off of 40,000 square miles of Ozark Plateau. They just cut it off and made bridge timbers and railroad ties, and they built railroads to the west. By 1940, between 1880 and 1940, in that 80-year period, they clear-cut it all off. In 1940, some pictures taken on this farm shows it to be a barren wasteland. Barren wasteland at the end of the Great Depression. So what we see here today in the last 60 years of growth, just my lifetime, is what has been restored. The trees have come back, not the topsoil. Where's our topsoil? Well, when they cut the forest off, it rained on the topsoil, washed it away, it eroded down the Mississippi River. Started in the White River, went on down to the Mississippi River, went on down to New Orleans, and was deposited out there in the Delta. If you want to know where our topsoil is from Ozark County, it's south of New Orleans. That's erosion. That's where our topsoil is. But, here are the numbers. You go back 65 million years, and there should be 6,500 feet of topsoil in some places around the world because the dinosaurs died out, remember, 65 million years ago? Do the numbers, add them up, get your calculator out there, and just put down a foot every 1,000 years, and how many 1,000 years are there in 65 million, and that's how many feet you ought to have. There isn't any place on this planet that's got 65 feet of topsoil, let alone 6,500 feet. Well, I shouldn't say there isn't a place that didn't have 65 feet. There might be a hole in the ground someplace where the river washed in some silt 100 feet deep or something, but it didn't develop there over time the way it does by uniformitarianism, I'll tell you that. All right, so the topsoil over here is another proof that evolution's phony. Uniformitarianism is phony. And then we come to such things as meteorology. There was a guy by the name of Solomon. He was a scientist, Solomon was. And old Solomon made an observation in Ecclesiastes 1 verse 7. Solomon said that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea isn't full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. I told you last time or the time before, I said the Bible is just full of science. And while it isn't a science textbook, it is definitely a science book. It's got science all over it. The word science means knowledge. It's got knowledge from cover to cover. And it's got knowledge concerning the physical sciences like meteorology. Listen to this statement again. It isn't in 4 or 5 syllable words, or in some word that you've never heard before, nobody else has either, in some particular discipline called meteorology. It's in plain, simple language. It says, all of the rivers run into the sea. Well, that's a pretty scientific statement. The Mississippi River runs into the sea. The White River runs into the Mississippi River. The Missouri River runs into the Mississippi River. All of the rivers run into the sea. All of the water runs into the oceans, boys and girls. Pretty scientific statement. And yet the sea is not full. There's still more room in the ocean for more water. It's always got room for more water. The Amazon River is running into the ocean, and it's got room for more. Tomorrow, it isn't going to fill up the ocean today or tomorrow or next week. You can rest assured that all of the rivers running into the oceans at the rate of 286,000 cubic miles of water a year running into the oceans. All of you people in Biloxi, you don't need to be too concerned about the water coming up and flooding your house. Sit back and relax. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. So wherever it is that the rivers come from, they return again. Remember that story? We call it the circle or cycle of evaporation and precipitation. And the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came. And indeed they do. Indeed they do. The sun sucks the water up by evaporation, condenses it into clouds, and precipitates it out in rain, and it falls on the ground and washes down the mountains, into the river, and then out to the Mississippi and down to the Gulf of Mexico. Very scientific statement. And the rivers aren't full. The guy that made that statement did that about 900 to 1000 BC. Pretty smart guy, wouldn't you say? Or is he writing under inspiration of the Holy Spirit, and what we're listening to here are the words of God Almighty himself, telling us, hey, let me explain to you how this system works. Very simple, straightforward statement. Hell, even a kindergartner could understand that. Called meteorology. Meteorology. And then there's a story about the light being parted. In Job 38, verse 24, we read a scientific question. It says, by what way is it that the light is parted? You know, you almost have to be a scientist to understand what's being talked about here. Light being parted? How do you part light? Paraphrased, it says, by what way or technique is the light apportioned or separated? Now, can you imagine asking that 4,000 years ago? Today, it's a simple question. The student instantly answers, well, by passing it through the prism of the spectroscope. But who could have known about a spectroscope 4,000 years ago back in Job's day? Yeah, the Bible is filled with science. God was asking Job a few questions, a few scientific questions. In fact, he asked Job 40 scientific questions, and when he got all through asking Job these 40 scientific questions, today, in 2005, we can answer four of those questions, 10%. The other 36 are just as much a mystery today as they were in Job's day 4,000 years ago. We don't know. Haven't got a clue. And God has said time and time again, you know, who's gone to the bottoms of the oceans and taken a look at the fountains of the great deep? You know, until the last 30 or 40 years, we did not know that there were springs and rivers that were flowing out of the fountains of the great deep to this day. Wasn't that just special? So when we look in the Bible, we find science. When we look at religion, we find speculation and foolishness in religion. When we look at science, we see evolution, more foolishness, speculation. Science comes from the Bible. Science doesn't come from religion, and science doesn't come from evolutionary philosophy. That's the bottom line. Hey, I'm just about out of time. We're going to have to close this show down. We'll be back tomorrow night with something new. I'll go through my magic list over here, and we'll find out some new topic that we can investigate, and we will take a look at it and see what we can learn. Meanwhile, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening and good night, friends.